we're surrounded by stories that just don't add up. Choices that appear to be baffling, actions that defy logic. But what if there's more to the story? On How Did It Make Sense, we explore the power of learning from experience and digging into the second stories that are always present. We talk to experts from diverse fields who are challenging the way we think about safety, risk, and decision making. Join us as we unlock the lessons hidden within everyday events. Some of these are high risk and some appear to be mundane, but all of them show how we can create a fairer, safer, and more resilient world. Welcome to another episode of How Did It Make Sense from Human in the System? And the goal of these podcasts is to explore first stories and second stories. The first stories are those which are simple, linear, they don't contain all the information, and as a consequence, we jump to conclusions, and that's normal human behavior. And then we'll dig into a second story which explores that context and how did it make sense for those people involved to do what they did, because they were exercising their own local rationality. Most people, I'm going to say it's a generalism, most people don't go to work to do a bad job. They're trying to do the best they can. And we're interviewing and having conversations with people in multiple different domains, not just high-risk industries, but also sort of personal behaviors and leadership and all sorts. So, Ben, welcome to this podcast. Tell the audience who you are, what you do, how do you get to where you are, and where people can find you.
Great. Thank you, Gareth. I really appreciate being here, and I love what you're doing, and it's fabulous. I often use some of your thinking in terms of just asking, well, how did it make sense for someone to have done something? I think that's a very revealing question. So I'm Ben Cattaneo. I am the founder of the Decision Making Studio, which is my advisory firm, and very boutique firm. It's been around for just over a year, and I help individuals and organizations make quality decisions under uncertainty. And I got to where I'm doing it. So there's the linear version and there's a non-linear version. I'll try and give you the linear version, which is simply I spent many years in the field of corporate and strategic risk management, most recently at BT Group here in the UK. I'm based in London, although I'm Canadian by where I grew up. And I just got kind of frustrated with the fact that a lot of work that I thought is very important and an industry and a field called risk management was really just divorced from decision making. I always looked at it as we help people make good decisions. And what seems to be happening, and it's an interesting phenomenon because I think it's happening in lots of other fields where decisions get made and then later, afterwards, we write down all the risk factors and it goes into some sort of report and people are happy because there's a report that gets produced. I was just getting very frustrated by that. And I, in parallel, I've been doing a podcast as well for many years and I've been getting all these ideas. We're talking about Annie Duke and I've had her on the show three times and all this wonderful, cool, rich stuff that I was finding really difficult to apply in my day-to-day job. And so I said, screw this, I am going to go out on my own. And I founded the Decision Making Studio. And so I work with clients around problems that have lots of uncertainty, ambiguity, complexity to them. So things like ethical decision-making or geopolitics or, you know, things of that nature, where there's lots of factors, there's no clear right answer. And what I do is just simply help people with the how around making these decisions. I don't tell people what to do, but I give people tools, ways of thinking, frameworks, ways in which they might be able to look at a problem a little bit differently. And they come up with, you know, solutions, ways forward, because they know their area. I'm helping them with that. So that's more or less what I do. And I can be found at thedecisionmaking.studio. Ben@thedecisionmaking.studio is my email address if anyone wants to reach out. Cool. But yeah, and we've got a podcast.
We'll stick that in the show notes.
Share stuff. Cool. And, sure. Yeah.
That's brilliant. That's really cool. And I think it's a critical piece is where, when you're in that sort of consultancy type role and, you know, it's sort of very trope trite statement, but you sit there, you help them find the answers. You're not the expert in their space. And, and if they've helped find those answers, there's some level of ownership and they move on. And so thank you for that. Ben, what is that first story then that that you want to share to people?
This will be a little bit off the cuff and a little bit of I'm going to throw in different factors here from different places. Mm-hmm. It's a story. It's a single story, but because of the nature of it, I don't want to make it really obvious what I'm talking about. So look, very simply, the example is in an organizational context, this is an organization I've worked with, and they had an opportunity to enter a new market, so the Chinese market. And mm-hmm. they thought, well, this is great, because they got all the sort of licenses, and they thought huge consumer market, huge opportunity, and so we'll go in. Have to negotiate with a joint venture partner. That's fine. Set everything sort of up, but it didn't really go as planned, and forecasted revenues just weren't there. There's a lot of things I just didn't understand about doing business in mm-hmm. that market, and then things took a bit of a turn with the relationship between the U.S. and China over the last few years. Been well publicized, and mm-hmm. a number of contextual factors in that work in technology, so lots of security concerns and things that with the benefit of hindsight they probably should have knew mm-hmm. about or considered but didn't, ended up having to leave and at either a loss or not having made much money, but not worth it.
It wasn't a major success. Yeah.
So not a major success.
So it's sort of a simple, no. And so, you know, that first story might be organization goes into new field, fails because they didn't understand the landscape in which they're operating. Mm. And I'm pretty sure that that's not an unusual story. Because there are lots of organizations who, for whatever reason, start going into that space. And it's really, I need to go and find those episodes from Annie Duke, because I've just finished reading her book of Quit. Mm. And there are so many things in there, so many great examples of the reasons why people carry on, why they don't end early, why they don't quit. And there's a whole bunch of sort of social, cultural and technical reasons that come into that, cognitive biases as well. So Ben, are you able to explore that local rationality? What are the reasons why they ended going into that market to start with and then missed some of the signs? And actually, as a learning point, what were the trigger points that allowed them to get out? Because you could say, actually, if they quit, that's a success, rather than staying there and sitting there going, no, and burning money as they go along. So I think there's two sides to this. So over to you,
Ben. They certainly didn't say that we're quitting and therefore that's a success. And I think that's a kind of a fundamental problem with organizations, is that, you know, I'm a big advocate for this thing called decision quality, which is all about how you decide. How we decide is fundamental, because we don't have control over all the variables. We only can make the best decision we can based on what we knew at the time. Now, the benefit of hindsight, there were loads of questions that they could have asked, but they did not ask. Mm-hmm. And that's interesting. Because then, you know, we talk about the sort of the local rationality. I think there are lots of factors there. And I think just more broadly, if I could just kind of
make a broader point.
I think organizations and the way that we govern ourselves, the way that organizations are governed, it just hasn't kept pace with the way the world is. That the world is uncertain, it's complex, and we need to hold leaders to account for the quality of the decisions they make. Not to the outcomes, because outcomes can be generated by a combination of, you know, skill and luck. And so we need to be able to go back. And this is the fundamental problem. Like I'm giving you this anecdotally, but I can't go back and say, this is exactly what they knew at the time they made this decision. This is why they made it. This is what they considered. This is what they failed to consider. That's where we need to get to. And so I'm giving you this kind of anecdotally, but I'm willing to bet that 99% of the time with big strategic decisions, most organizations can't do that, can't sort of go back. I keep something called a decision journal, by the way. So anytime I make a big decision, I kind of write down what I know, my assumptions, what I'm trying to achieve. And then I can kind of go back and say, well, is something different? And in spite of all the data that organizations have and keep and have access to, they're really not able to do that. They're not able to go back and say, this is what we knew, this is what we tried to know. So I'm trying to piece this together from hindsight. So that's a very complex, so maybe we're diving into the second part of this, but
no, that's really important is understanding, you sort of scoping the limitations of how we make decisions individually and organizationally.
Yeah. So there are two or three things that were going on. I think one was a bit of a hype factor. So a few years ago, everyone was moving into China and it was sort of a hot market, even though there are all these, the tide was turning, but it was sort of, there's a FOMO thing, which is very interesting because you've got lots of rational people who have, you know, advanced degrees in things like finance or strategy or MBAs, but they're actually making quite, you know, quite emotional, intuitive decisions. Intuition is not necessarily a bad thing, but in this case, there was some FOMO going on. So that's part of it. I think the second thing that was going on is that this is a business unit that was in some financial duress. So they're not quite hitting their targets, needing.
So you're in the losses already. Yeah.
Yeah. Not necessarily in the losses, but you know, it's just sort of a bit hit and miss whether or not they would hit their targets every year. And the strategy was questioned and they needed a win, you know? And so there was that going on.
So when I would talk about the loss, so just the losses piece there is, it's that it sort of turns from Annie Duke's bit of actually you're either winning or you're losing.
Yeah.
And if you're not winning, you've got to be in the losses. So actually that it, rather than they're losing stuff, they're not in the winning space. So sorry, apologies, squad.
Yeah, no, that's good. Really good concept. So I think there's a bit of like we need to change the narrative. We need to change things because what we're doing isn't working. And so it's almost, you know, sometimes when you're when you're getting a little desperate, you take bigger and bigger risks. And so I think that played into it. And so the questions that they could have and should have asked, they just didn't. And so, so that I think was.
And is that because they don't know the question to ask, or is it because the social setting doesn't allow those questions to be asked?
That's so interesting. I think it's probably a combination. But when you start to bring in maybe experts on the country or some case studies of like what are other companies experiencing when they're doing something similar, there was some resistance to hearing those, which to me tells
me that it's not the story we want to hear.
It's not the story we want to hear. So we're going to sort of downplay, or we're unique, we're different, this isn't going to happen to us. So they, you know, the likelihood of experiencing what those guys experienced, that isn't, you know, that's much less for us. We're much better. We're, you know, this sort of thing. So there's quite a lot of collective delusion, a lot of bias. So there wasn't a failure to ask the right questions, but I think there was a lot of gamesmanship in theater that we are doing, say, a risk assessment or this or that to kind of show that, you know, we've considered all these factors and we're doing something about, it's theater. So a fair bit of theater. I think fundamentally, you hit the nail on the head. It's this sort of form over substance. And I think driven by, if you really peel the layers back, it's executives under some stress, financial stress. There's this sort of some FOMO going on, and that colors everything else. And also you have to think about like in an organizational context. They call this the manager agent problem, in that the executives
explore that.
Yeah, so it's a term in economics actually, which means the people who are the agents are the shareholders, so that's their money. The executives are the managers, and so it's not their money. And it's just so managers can make decisions that are riskier because they might have to get another job, but ultimately it's not their, they don't have any skin in the game.
Interesting.
This is well studied in financial crises, for example, where you've got bankers who there's regulations around, you can claw back bonuses and things like this, but there are managers who make decisions, and if the bank blows up, well, the bank blows up, but it's not my money. If I don't hit my numbers, I don't get my bonus. And so it's a structural thing. It's a kind of a governance thing. And so I think there's a little bit of that involved as well. Incentive structures just don't align.
I would think there's also going to be the other way around, where the shareholders are demanding expected profits.
Yes. Yes.
And so that's going to drive behaviors the other way, that says basically, if we don't get those, we don't get the investment, we can't grow. Mm-hmm. And so those managers now don't get their internal bonuses. So there's got to be an interesting tension that exists there. And, one of the things I'm very keen about this podcast is to explore that this local rationality and how did it make sense is not just a sharp end issue. We often talk about those people get hurt and it's like, well, why did they do that? And you sit there and go, these same issues exist at multiple levels within the organization.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so this is why I keep coming back to this thing about governance, because, shareholders, boards, all of these structures that we have need to be able to look at an organization and say, are these guys making good decisions? Right. So if you've got the same, FOMO pressure on the people who are actually representing the shareholders, and they're not able to ask those kinds of questions, then you can see where things kind of go wrong. You can see how the kind of the structures get enmeshed in this sort of stuff. I think we're now diving to the more, a bit of the nonlinear. Because there's a lot going, once you start to throw all these variables there, it becomes really interesting. I also find that in my field, or I call myself a recovering risk management professional. So we're very good at pointing out, why things went wrong or how things could go wrong, or, this sort of thing, but we're not that great at, and I'm talking about the risk profession, we're not that great at actually figuring out how people make decisions and how it made sense for this to happen.
Yeah.
That part is really interesting. And if, for example, we were just to go back in time and just start thinking about this particular decision and just say, whoa, wait a minute, let's unpack this a little bit. And one of the things that I think is really important in any decision making process, which doesn't happen, is a lack of framing. And one of the key questions I think is, what's the problem we're really trying to solve here? And the problem, if we ask that, and if we're transparent about that and honest about that, is that, like, look, we're not doing too hot. We need to we need to find ways to reverse the trend. And that's really the problem we need to solve. Not how can we make this opportunity in China work?
Get into that market or beat other people.
Yeah.
Yes,
or launch this product. It could be anything. It doesn't have to be moving to this. It could be, I think a lot of this stuff on AI, for example, is happening right now, with a lot of organizations think that they need to be in AI and do this. And it's very, very interesting, because AI is an efficiency play, and all of a sudden, if everyone's doing the same stuff, everyone becomes just as efficient, and it just there's no real innovation happening. Is you kind of have to do it. But anyway, if when that decision was made, the question simply was, how can we improve our market position,
revenue generation for that business unit?
Exactly. Yeah. Rather than how can we make this China thing work, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, being very clear on the problem that you really need to solve is crucial, and that takes honesty and that takes some humility, right? And so the local rationality thing is, I don't think there was a lot of humility at all, because I think there's, you know, you've got senior leaders who don't want to admit making mistakes, don't want to admit how they got into this financial mess in the first place, because a lot of those execs were still sort of there.
Even the word admit has got a negative connotation to it. And if you own part of that decision making, the sort of the IKEA effect or the endowment effect, where actually, you know, we're now part of that. That's part of what we do. It's really hard to step away from that and say that was a bum decision. For a whole bunch of other, you know, social, cultural, cognitive reasons.
Yeah. And so it's hard to have that honest conversation. And I try to put myself into in the shoes of an executive, where a few things that just if I had them back, I would have done them better. But I'm not going to admit that, because then there's an admission of, you know, weakness or incompetence or something. And then this is a real thing in organizations, and you're kind of competing against your peers and this sort of thing. So you're not really going to do that unless there's a culture of that at a leadership team level, where we were able to actually say, this is the decision I made, this is why I made it, this is what I knew at the time, this is what I didn't know. And so, fine, with the benefit of hindsight, it didn't work out, but at the time, this was how I made it, and if you transported me back to that same spot, I probably would have done the same thing, and that's where we want to get to. That's not an easy conversation to have at senior leadership levels, but it's increasingly a conversation that we need to have in our organizations and in our societies, and that requires a huge leadership shift. So that's partly what I'm trying to do.
Yeah, it's really cool. And that's really what your business is about, I'm guessing, then, from what we're discussing, is helping people in that situation. And, you know, I do it at a team level, and maybe multiple teams, not at the board level. But it's that piece that says, we've got to create the environment where there is low professional jeopardy when we explore these decisions, and get people to understand their sort of cognitive, social, cultural behaviours. Because of the context they're in, and then sit them and go, right, now we're going to move from a no jeopardy situation, knowing that this is how our brains behave and how we as a peer group behave, right, let's move that into the professional jeopardy situation, and giving them the tools to sit there and go, right, how do we isolate this, and just sit there and go, right, what is it that we can do to help us to make better decisions in the here and the now, that afterwards we sit there going, oh, they're stupid. But that's also this recognition that we're all fallible. And I think until there is that acceptance of fallibility, and it's one of the things, you go into an organization and trying to develop a just culture, which is really about supporting that you can't develop a just culture in an organization until you have overtly accepted fallibility within anybody within the system. It doesn't matter if you're a low-level frontline operator or whether or not you're part of the C-suite. You are human. You've got performance variability.
This is so important, Gareth, and this is the shift that we need to make, that there's recognition that we are all fallible. And what I found in my first year in business is this is a really part message to get across. So I'll give you this kind of standard response when I start to talk to organizations about decision making and decision quality. Is the higher up I go, the less recognition there seems to be that we are all fallible. It seems like the standard response I tend to get is, look, I'm a great decision maker. That's why I'm in the C-suite.
That's why I'm in the position I'm in.
That's what exactly. Now those bastards down the hall, however, they're not so great. So you should talk to them. And it is a big problem in our organization, but not with me, of course. I'm on your side, but with some of my colleagues, my God, I don't know how they, get through the day. And it's a cycle that kind of continues. And I think it takes a very courageous, brave leader. And this is a big leadership change that we need to be able to say, no, we are all fallible. I, as the CEO, the chair, the CFO, whatever, I am fallible. And this is what we're doing to account for that. And I think that that's the type of thing the successful organization of the future will be like that. But we're in a transition, transition phase. There are far fewer organizations that are like that. But it's hard to pin down an individual. So we've almost designed in the wrong kinds of structures in many places, because I can see why a manager wouldn't do that. Like if I was a senior, I can see why I wouldn't want to do that.
Yeah, what do you reward? What do you punish?
So I can see how I wouldn't know. I cannot. And when people tell me this, I can see also, I can understand that. So it's almost like a puzzle or mystery. It's a very naughty problem.
And another dimension to that, and I was just thinking about some work that I've done for my own studies and the papers and things that I've read, is that the more context we have in a story, the less likely we are to judge others. And that's why we're doing these sort of first story, second story pieces. And so just thinking about how organizations structure their internal communications.
Yeah.
But at the operational level, you might have a really thick story that tells you all that context. And as it aggregates up and goes up into the senior decision makers, the C-suite, it becomes one or two lines.
Exactly.
And the problem is, when we don't have all of that information, our human tendency, fundamental attribution bias error, is that we jump into that and we fill the gaps in with what we believe we would have done, knowing what the outcome is. But in real time, people don't know with 100% certainty what the outcome's going to be like. It's a variety of different outcomes, and we see what it is. And so I think when you start telling learning-focused reports, you start to understand that quality because you've got the narrative. But the aggregation and the simplification goes up. We lose that detail. And that's just sort of come to me just now as looking at some of the papers that I was thinking about actually putting in the show notes here.
It's a huge struggle, because senior leaders, and it's getting harder, senior leaders are so time crunched, and you get only a few minutes. Everything that you submit to a CEO has got to be super, super punchy. Half a page, like it's very challenging, and getting more and more challenging. The amount of paperwork that an executive committee member has, it, I'm thinking about my at BT Group, for example, they would have to read is just a mountain of stuff every executive committee meeting. And it's just, how do you make sense of this? So everything's got to be short, punchy.
Trust your team.
So
If they give me some
this is
information,
interesting.
trust them that actually it's the correct answer. And almost that piece, and just thinking of David Marquette's Turn the Ship Around, is that bit of I intend to. So, the delegated authority is, and he was saying the only things that he would give executive decisions over was weapons release. Anything else was the team got on and did stuff and trusted his team to do that, as opposed to this sort of micromanaging, rubber stamping. And that might be organizational structures that say, we don't trust those people, only the execs can sign off on this. And you think, actually, what are they doing? Because they can't know the detail.
I fully with you on that. The other thing, and I'm keen to get your thoughts on this, that I think organizations try to solve some of these problems with more processes or better processes or things like that. And I just think that what's actually far better is to have a smaller, very, almost emotive set of heuristics that, look, we will do this or not do that, or, this kind of a thing to guide and devolve decision making throughout the organization. And that's
Absolutely,
some of
because
the
I don't
things.
think we, organizations talk about risk management, and most of the stuff we're doing is uncertainty management, which is heuristics, biases, mental shortcuts, and actually coming up with some easy, ready reckoners and say, right, this is go, no go. This is not. And, what those could be when you kick the project off. And, the sort of the red teaming tools that can help you decide those sorts of things to sit there and go, right, what are the assumptions we're making? What if they're not true? How do we know they're not true? What would be the indications before it all goes bang that things are starting to deviate? And I think the team at Effective Direction, Marcus Dimbleby, and the team he's got together are really all about building those that applied critical thinking that allows people to build those shortcuts in place, mental shortcuts in place, rather than right, and then people just lose interest.
It's again, it's another one of these big mindset shifts that I think that, and also the opportunity is there for organizations to take a lead on this. Is I don't think it's the vast majority of organizations that are doing this, but the few that start, that's interesting. And I've had Professor Dave Snowden on my show recently, and I love his stuff. But one of the things I keep coming back to is his sort of distinction between complex and complicated, and the complex is the stuff where we don't always have an obvious right answer, where experts disagree, and we continue to design for I think complicated, which is more like an engineering problem. So a lot of the risk management stuff is designed for complicated. It's not designed for complex. So
Correct, yeah.
having the heuristics, all the critical thinking stuff, and just what are the constraints, the boundaries that that we can put in place or there that are in
Yeah.
place is very crucial to understand. Another factor, just go back to this case that I just to throw into the mix here, was that this is a big organization, so there's lots of this is not the only business unit that so this business unit wanted to do business in China, but just about everybody has got a big supply base from China, certainly in the tech space. So there are other parts of the business that were just that after the decision was made that thought, you're doing what? Right? We've got, we've got, for example, government clients over here. They're not going to be too happy with this. Like, what access to, are you giving your JV partners to our systems? And, how does that affect our these clients we have over here,
Interesting.
or we've got this big, this big supply base here, and well, what if this is unavailable or that's unavailable because there's a commercial dispute? Like, there's stuff that that just also wasn't considered. Again, it's a sort of local rationality, is that, well, this is my business unit. I'm making a decision for my business unit. I don't particularly know or care how this affects others, because that's not what I'm incentivized to do. I'm incentivized to make my unit a success. And so it's that, those internal connections in big, complex organizations.
It was internal competitions.
Yeah, yeah. And so
you hold the company name, you are a department or a business unit inside mm-hmm. that company name, but actually you're in competition inside your organization.
Yeah.
And that mm-hmm. that drives, I'm going to say it's got to, and I know it does, it drives mm-hmm. wrong behaviors, because mm-hmm. you end up competing against finite resources. Mm-hmm. And so you end up with situations that you just described. Hey, we've got this cool capability. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, what risk does that bring to the rest of the organization mm-hmm. in terms of contract, in terms of security? It's a really interesting piece. You said your profession was sort of the risk management side. How much do you focus on the reward element of risks? Obviously, risk is often considered the loss. But do mm-hmm. you actually ask, why are people behaving the way they do, and what are their rewards mm-hmm. that they're moving towards?
Yeah. So, Gareth, I'm going to preface that by saying I'm a recovering risk professional. I no longer call myself a risk professional. So I've kind of, not that I fully denounced risk management, but I've just gotten so sort of disillusioned with it that I don't really. So I'm a recovering risk professional.
That's fair.
And so I'm all about decision quality, which covers the upside and the downside. Is it a good decision? Are we optimizing our chances of success? Yeah. Are we are we protecting the downside? And to me, there's almost a the risk management as a field has a bit of a complex, and a lot of risk professionals say, oh, hey, well, I don't just do bad risk, I also do opportunities. But that to me is just the what that is kind of like, If risk management was a high school student, they're trying to be one of the cool kids, right? But they're kind of so there's a complex going on that if you really were about opportunities, then you'd be part of the commercial team for me, I find it a bit of a tired kind of a debate, and so I just talk about good decisions, and that covers the upside, the downside, the thinking about the unintended, and it's just a far richer and just more real, practical space. So if you want anything to kind of go, in quotes, viral on LinkedIn in the risk space, then you start talking about risk is opportunity as well.
One of the previous guests, Ben Goodhart, we were just talking about ice climbing, mountaineering. And why would people do that? Because the loss is there. You go, but it's the exposure. Yeah. It's the opportunity to get out there and push our boundaries. So the adventure sports is an interesting piece when it comes to that risk management piece.
Yes.
So go on.
Sure. No, it's just, the sort of the lessons that, because that's real risk, like that's if you get that wrong, then the consequence in your space, you get something wrong, it's a life or death situation potentially, and that makes it all very, very real. And most people that work in,
dismiss that.
Yeah.
I think in the adventure sports space, most people sort of don't really consider the fatal outcomes because they don't hear about it and it doesn't happen very often. So again, we're in a heuristic space that, yes, it's there, but nobody, in the grand scheme of things, the risk of dying on a dive is about 1 in 200,000 dives. And people sit there and go, well, I'm never going to do 200,000 dives, therefore I'm not going to die.
Right.
And the logical person will go, well, that's really stupid. that where you look at it, it's like, well, no, it's not, because that's how our mental shortcut process works. So it applies in the adventure sports space as well, but it's much more visceral. It's there. So
yeah, it's much more visceral. And I'm a cyclist, and I, you know, cycling is potentially, you know,
road cycling.
Yeah. And, you know, there are all these, it doesn't take, it's not high likelihood, but it doesn't take much for something to, you know, you could be riding in a group and touch the front wheel and, you know, and it's just a moment. It could be just a moment. And, it's very hard for our brains to wrap our heads around that. And the odds,
the uncertainties that are there.
Yeah.
It's easy just to ignore it. There we go. So the final section of the sort of podcast is a book or a paper or a video that you'd recommend people go and sort of consume that helps understand some of the concepts that you believe in or that we've discussed in this session. So what would you recommend? And it doesn't have to be one. You could put multiple ones in there. I'll stick in the show notes. Look, it's not a problem.
I highly recommend Annie Duke stuff. I'm a huge fan. So my favorite is her first book, Thinking in Bets, which I really, it's a wonderful way of think of framing decisions as bets, and just a nice reminder, even if you say, you know, 1 in 200,000 or one, you know, that we can only make the, we can play the best hand or make a certain bet. There's always a chance to, that things go south, and just that mindset just helps bring out the right questions. Oh, should I be betting? I think her stuff is great. Gary Klein's stuff is fabulous. I've kind of swung a little bit more in the direction of the importance of intuition and naturalistic decision making than I was I think earlier in my career, and I think I had a bit of a, you could quantify everything and come up with a calculus, and intuition matters, and insights matter, and his stuff on insights, I think, is fabulous, and I highly recommend his work. But there's loads of stuff that's out there.
That's cool. And I think one of the big bits that comes out of Gary Klein's work is the importance of experience to understand that you don't know what you don't know, or that bit where expertise allows you to see the invisible, where something isn't quite right because it's not there, whereas novices will look for things to be present in the scene to help understand what that situation is. And going back to that piece of putting processes in place or using AI, that really, it doesn't help build our experiential knowledge and our critical thinking. It's basically ding, 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 ding. And whoever wrote that process is the one that's putting the critical decision trees in place, or the AI is programmed, you know, as a synthesis tool. I think AI is fantastic. As a critical decision-making tool in uncertainty, there's a whole world of hurt waiting out there for people if they don't recognize the limitations.
Yeah, I agree.
So, Ben, thank you very much for your time today. It's been really cool. And just, you know, we were talking beforehand of always learning. And so listening to you talk about some of the stuff just sort of reinforces bits that I know, but also give me some new ideas about things. So, and I hope that's the same with the listeners. So, Ben, thank you very much. I'll put your contact details in the show notes. And if anybody's interested, go and find him. Thanks very much.
Gareth, thank you very much.